Good morning, folks. This is the Cosmic Citizen. We're starting a new feature, folks, called Ministry of the Month. And what we're going to be doing is we're going to be highlighting a Urantia Book-based ministry every month. And for the next few weeks, we'll be playing segments of an interview that I did with Mo Siegel, who is founder of TruthBook.com. Some of you probably are familiar with TruthBook.com. It's one of my favorite Urantia Book websites. And so we'll be playing that for you at the bottom of the hour. Right in the middle of the show, we'll be playing a couple minutes of my interview with Mo Siegel, and we'll be doing that for the next few weeks. We'll be spotlighting truthbook.com this month. Today, we are also spotlighting our guests. We have two wonderful, beautiful, adorable, fantastic guests today, and they've been with us before, and we are glad to welcome them back again. Our first guest is Diane LeBrecq. Diane LeBrecq is a Urantia Book reader from Canada. She has spoken with us before about the faith of Jesus. She has is also a regular caller to the show. She's just been a longtime student of the book, and she's just a great person to have on board with us here at the Cosmic Citizen. Diane, welcome to the show again.
Welcome. Thank you, Andre. Hi, Paula.
Hi, Diane.
And also with us is Ann Garner. Ann Garner has a distinguished record as a longtime UB student. She's been reading the book, I think, since 1979. She found it in 79, and she told me she started reading it in like 81. But she is involved with interfaith movement, with a lot of interfaith stuff. She is involved a lot with different Christian pastors and ministries as well. She's just a real multifaceted, multi-talented person. And welcome again to the Cosmic Citizen.
Well, thank you, and hello, hello, Paula. Hello, my sister Diane.
Hi, Anne.
And wow, what an introduction. Paula.
Well, you know, today on the show, we're going to be focusing again on Jesus, which is something that both Diane and Anne are great at discussing. And given that it's the Christmas season, I think it's highly appropriate to do this. We're going to be talking today about two things, but two very related things. I suppose you could say it's one seamless thing. We're going to talk about the birth of Jesus and what the Urantia Book tells us about the birth of Jesus, what things that we know already that are true and what things need to be corrected. But we're also going to be talking about the incarnation, the implications of the incarnation. What does it mean that God became man? So I guess, normally I have a question, opening question. But I guess I actually don't really at the moment. I do have one question, but it's kind of a controversial question. I'll save it. So I guess let's start a little bit about the birth of Jesus. Either Diane, either you or Anne can start. It really doesn't matter. But I'd like to begin by asking, kind of by building on what I just said a minute ago, which is how much of what we know from Christian tradition about the birth of Jesus is true, and how much needs to be upgraded and corrected a little bit?
Well, I would like to say, first of all, Andre, I'm sorry, I would like maybe to acknowledge the presence of our omnipresent, beautiful Jesus. I think it would be wonderful to recognize it verbally, since we are two or three and he's gathered here among us. And I would like to say that this morning I was surprised to know that it is very close to the same thing from the Urantia Book in different sources. Other places it is different, but this morning I made the discovery of your beautiful little book that my sister found a few days ago in the basement of a church at $2. And as I saw the book, I thought it was I had such a good feeling about the book. I said, what is this? And it says in French, the Gospel of Jesus. So I opened it up. And lo and behold, this morning, as I was awake around 3 or 4 in the morning, I was getting ready for the preparing for the show. And then I discovered in the book, it comes straight from Italy, from Rome. And it's from the church, a Christian church and all this. And 1970, so we're going back almost 40 years, 38 years, 39 a few weeks from here. And it already starts at the beginning clarifying things which impressed me, because they say right there and then, following new calculations that have been done and so on, I will spare you all the details, it says, you know, the calendar, the Christian calendar has been counted from the birth of Jesus, which was zero, but now it seems that the new calculations reveal to us that Jesus was born 7 years before the Christian era, which really blew my mind. And then in the book, they also have a calendar of his life spread around in detailed, you know, years, and they actually give the exact time of his death, the day, April the 7th, A.D. 30, which was really interesting because I thought, there it is. They do not mention the Urantia book, but how could they get that? So answering your question, Andre, I find it very, very interesting to see that there pops up from around the world different information that seems to gradually be showing us that the Urantia book, the revelation of the Urantia book, is right on. And people, without wanting maybe to come up front and saying forward, hey, you know what, folks, this is from the Urantia book, it is. It is all converging toward the same information. And do you agree on that?
Yes, and I will come from an interfaith perspective. Just yesterday, I had a Zoroastrian priest call me. He's a very wonderful man of God. And as you know, the Zoroastrian is a very ancient religion. And that's where the Magi came from, the wise man. So he wanted to talk about the birth of Jesus. And it was fascinating. Of course, he said, you know, Anne, we know in our history that Jesus was not born December 25th. I said, well, when did you, as a Zoroastrian priest, one of the greatest priests that I've ever known, you know, around the planet, he said, well, you know, and he called them I cannot pronounce it the way he does, the Magog is the way he pronounced it, the wise man. He said, we believe that he was born in either August or September because they were, you know, he said a lot of Zoroastrians have always been in astronomy. And I asked him, I said, well, why, and I posed this question to you also, the three of you. I said, why do you think there was divine guidance for these men to find Jesus? He said, you know, Anne, that question has never been posed to me. I'm about to go to India, and I will ask our main teacher, which is the equivalent of the Pope in the Catholic faith. And then the Sikh priest earlier this week started asking me, and he also believes that Jesus was born in September. So the other religions are beginning to openly discuss the birth of Jesus in a way that I had not experienced in many years. And so there are a lot of implications going on here.
You know, I was the first time I heard that concept that Jesus was not born in December was from the Jehovah's Witnesses. I studied with them when I was 16. And they said several things that were then when I found 4 years later when I found the Urantia book were confirmed for me in the book, and it really struck a chord with me. They said Jesus was, and everything they get, the Jehovah's Witnesses get about this, about Jesus, they get right from the Bible, and they study the Bible very intensely, and I've always admired them for that. And they allow themselves a different interpretation. One thing they do is they don't celebrate Christmas because they believe it's a pagan holiday. And we know it is, but it's okay. I mean, I don't think God holds it against us for celebrating anything, especially the birth of Jesus. But they told me Jesus wasn't born in December because the Bible says the shepherds were abiding it with their fields by night, and they figured they wouldn't be doing that in December. I thought that was interesting. They were the first to tell me that Jesus and Michael are the same being, and they got that right from the Bible. They were the first to tell me that Jesus had brothers and sisters, and they got that right from the Bible. And the first to tell me that they did not believe Mary was a virgin, obviously, because they believed Jesus had brothers and sisters. So right within Christianity, you know, if you get certain sects that dare to think outside the box, then they come up with some very interesting things. And the other thing I wanted to point out about, historical scholars know that King Herod died in 3 B.C. So if he died then, how on earth did he send those soldiers out to kill those young male babies? So they know Jesus wasn't born when, history thinks he was. And
exactly.
There's been much speculation about maybe when he was born, but they know it wasn't, what we think it is, what the world typically thinks it is.
At the same time, what I feel? It's that if we look at the deeper meaning of it, if we look at the spiritual meaning we like to say that we want to be spiritual. If we look at the true spiritual meaning of Christmas, being Christ Mass, the Mass of Christ, the Mass of people who believe in the Christ mind, which is the message of Jesus, the message of love, the gathering, the Mass of the believers in the gospel of love, the people that believe in that. So the date really doesn't mean anything. It could be February, it could be three times a year, depending on which part of the globe, just like they have three implantations. We could have three times of the year, depending on where we are on the planet. To me, it doesn't matter as long as we understand the deep value of it, which is the gathering. And, every time I live in a commercial area where it's absolutely so beautiful during this time, there's carols on the street, the decorations, people smiling, and I think to myself, God, wouldn't it be beautiful if we stretch that all year round? People are nice to one another. They're gentle. They're actually bearing the fruits of the Spirit. And they don't ask one another on the street, which religion are you from, when they do a service, when they give alms, or when they help someone in a certain situation. They don't ask first, tell me if you're from my religion and then I'll help you. But the true message of Jesus was really that, love one another as I have loved you. So when we gather, when we do a Mass in the name of Christ, that should be the message. And it's wonderful to see on my street, which is a very commercial street, that Jews, Gentiles, Zoroastrians, Hindus, Buddhists, Muslims, everybody is there. And everybody's celebrating and smiling. So the idea is just to find a way to stretch it over the year and to keep that in mind as a momentum,
Yeah, I think it's really... I guess one of the things I want to kind of build on again is something that you said, Paula, that, it's okay to celebrate. Not only is it okay to celebrate Christmas, even if it's a pagan holiday, but it's, I think we need to be, I hope that we don't become a smug as the Urantia Book readers either and say, well, Jesus was born on August 21st, so we're not going to celebrate the birth of Jesus. I mean, we should be glad that people are celebrating the birth of Jesus. And if people still, if you want to celebrate the birth of Jesus twice a year on August 21st and celebrate on the 25th, God bless them. I mean, that's the way
right.
I look at it, And saying that, and I want to go ahead and get into a controversial issue,
Andre, before you go there, please,
sure.
I would like to make a couple of comments about the date and the birth. I love what the Zoroastrian said yesterday about the date. He said, and it doesn't matter. He said, I've said
that's
many
right.
times. He said, instead of the date, just give me a day with the great teacher Jesus. Instead of don't worry about the date, just give me a day to sit down and learn from his great teachings.
Mm.
And by the way, historically, the Zoroastrians get their accounts not from their scriptures, of course. That wouldn't make sense. They get a lot of it from the Christian scriptures. And he also brought up the fact of, yes, the pagans, on our interfaith council, we have a Wiccan, which... they're very beautiful people that they love nature. And he also brought up the Mithraism religion, that was a similar religion to the Zoroastrians. Some believe it kind of spun out of Zoroastrianism. That also was part, the story, the legend of Mithra. That's also a reason that the early church began to modify it, so that it was a compromise to bring in people into the church and help them feel comfortable. Okay, I wanted to make that point.
Okay. I just want to.
Ultimately, we should be celebrating the birth of Jesus every single day of the year.
Absolutely.
Yes, I like that.
Well, what does the song say? It says, what does the song Joy to the World say? It says, let every heart prepare him room. You know, so maybe
right.
what we need to be doing is celebrating the birth of Jesus in our hearts. And to the extent that celebrating the birth of Jesus helps us, you know, reminds us of that, that Jesus is born again in our hearts every day, that, you know, that it's a good thing. But I want to bring up a controversial issue, but it's one of the book gently, very gently, the Urantia book tells us very gently it does it very subtly and very gently. It says, Jesus came into the world normally and naturally, just like every other child. Okay? I'm paraphrasing because the book, I don't know the exact quote, but essentially the book denies the idea that Jesus was born of a virgin, that Mary had him by a supernatural virgin, you know, that she was conceived supernaturally. Okay? So what, I guess my question is, why do you think the book makes a point of telling us that? Why does the book gently but firmly correct that? In other words, why is it important to correct the idea that Jesus was born of a virgin?
Where do I begin?
Yeah, well, first of all, it's not biblical. You know, the scriptures were translated in many places from a young maiden, and it actually came up. I want to say this before Paula answers. I believe they had to clarify it because it actually came up in the infancy gospel of James in 150 A.D., where he became obsessed with the biological virginity, that everybody had to remain a virgin in order to be a believer, because they were looking for Jesus to come back any moment. That Mary was actually a young girl who was Joseph's, ward, and not really married. This Apocrypha laid the foundation of the Christian understanding, not the Bible. And I believe they had to correct it because of that's where the priesthood began, of don't, you know, and of course Paul, don't touch a woman, you know. So that was this obsession that anything that touched her would defile her. And in my opinion, that's how I would answer it.
But they do say in the Urantia book, page 1348, as you said, Anne, a maiden shall bear a child, you know, which became a virgin. But, you know, that's when we have to be very careful, because those problems of semantics, of misunderstanding, and as they tell us, you know, in those days, it was transferred from word of mouth. So when it goes from one tradition to the other one, then the words get so twisted. And to me, that's what wars have been all about, fighting about the same thing or what we think is the same thing, and yet with divergent point of views. And because of that, it creates big heavy-duty problems around the world, you know. So we've got to be very, very careful on the words we use or what we think is the truth, because some people will kill in the name of the Bible to say that she was an actual virgin, you know. And how do we interpret virgin? Was she a virgin? Because she was a virgin. She had not been with any other man before. And then she was a virgin married to Joseph, you know. Then other people will have other interpretations.
Well, this is one of those places, and Paul, I want to let you jump in because I know you want to talk about this. But you know, this is one of those places, I think, in the Urantia book that's kind of ambiguous, because it says that the word virgin, the word maiden was translated virgin, you know, later. But if you actually look, the problem is that the earliest translation we have of the Old Testament is what's called the Septuagint, which is a Greek translation of the Hebrew Scriptures. We don't have any earlier copies of Hebrew Scriptures, at least not that I know of, except for this Greek translation. So, the book refers to a prophecy. The Urantia book refers to a prophecy in Isaiah, which says that a maiden shall bear a son in Bethlehem. But if you actually look at the Greek word, it's Parthenon, which actually does mean, I think it means, it does mean either virgin or something like that. But then the Hebrew word is Alma, but the Hebrew translation is a later translation. So, I don't really know what to make of all that. I'm certainly not trying to doubt the Urantia book. I'm just saying, you know, it's an interesting passage. But I do believe the Urantia book is correct when it says that Jesus was born the normal and natural way. And I think one reason that's very important to point out is that Jesus was fully human as well as fully divine. So he had a human father and a human mother, and that didn't compromise his divinity at all.
And, you know, I think that if let's assume that you've read the whole Urantia book and now you've gotten up to this point about this, the fact of the bestowal of Jesus, which I love that word bestowal. It's beyond the word gift. It's much more than a gift. It's a bestowal. But if you have read the book up until this point, the book has elevated marriage, human marriage, as being humanly sacred. And it has told you now that this material life that we live is the only one in which you and I, a man and a woman, whomever, gets the opportunity to procreate and become parents in a natural sense. And it holds it up as being the highest human institution, humanly sacred. Why now would it go back to this notion that there's anything wrong with it? It's good and honorable in every sense of the word. And Jesus' birth to a man and a woman is good and honorable. And a woman is not defiled by a man. And a woman is not defiled because she is impregnated and gives birth to a child by the normal, natural methods. There is nothing filthy about that. It is beautiful. And the very fact that we would think that there's anything wrong with it is perverse. And we need to get over these perversions because they're extremes. A woman having to be a virgin to be good is as bad as saying, you know, the other extreme.
And especially, Paula, when you say that, I'm sorry, this morning my throat is a bit dry. I'm sorry, folks.
Okay.
When you say that a woman is not defiled, I would even go further than that and say, what about of all those so-called great men that walk upon the earth? Where did they originate? Where did they come from if it's not from a woman?
And a
so
man,
every
a family,
one of those
mother,
great...
Father. It's good. It's natural.
Exactly.
It's real.
So those very men that we look up at, presidents of the United States or religious men or the Pope or whatever, they all started at the same place as we girls start, from a mother's womb, a woman's womb. So this is to be absolutely sacred. It's to be respected, like you said, Paula, to be elevated.
I have to share a quote here because this, to me, you know, I've been thinking about this subject all week because we're preparing for it, and this is so poignant and so beautiful. It's from paper 121, The Times of Michael's Bestowal, and it just, you know, it's so beautiful. I'll let it speak for itself. It's section 4, The Incarnation, Making 2-1. Okay. Never lose sight of the fact that the supreme spiritual purpose of the Michael bestowal was to enhance the revelation of God. Urantia mortals have varying concepts of the miraculous, but to us, who live as citizens of the local universe, there are few miracles, and of these by far the most intriguing are the incarnational bestowals of the Paradise Sons. The appearance in and on your world by apparently natural processes of a divine son we regard as a miracle, the operation of universal laws beyond our understanding. Jesus of Nazareth was a miraculous person. In and through all this extraordinary experience, God the Father chose to manifest himself as he always does, in the usual way, in the normal, natural, and dependable way of divine acting.
That's beautiful, Paula. And, you know, I want to go back what you and Diane were talking about, this great mystery of incarnation. And as you all know, we're not supposed to focus on either that or his death and resurrection in our proclamation of the good news. And that, but I, and it's very good to be talking about this today. And but I want to go back to the early church. Something really happened in their mindsets when the church first started, and we all know, of course, that Jesus did not start Christianity as we know it today. It was a Greco-Roman environment where the, especially the Apostle Paul. But around, I believe it was around 95, you know, right in there, there became these intellects started coming into this movement. In the beginning, it was the common people, and they just were so glad to be able to come together and read these letters. All they had were some letters. But these intellects started coming in, these apologetics and these arguments, you might say. And they became extremely moralistic in their own mindset, that anything that touched us could would defile us. And so that's where it came in. And I go back to the priesthood, the Greek Orthodox, the Russian Orthodox, the Armenians, the Catholic Church. I went to two funerals in the last couple of 3 weeks, one a Catholic and one a Greek Orthodox. And you would have, I really thought I was back hundreds of years ago, you know, the procession and everything. So I believe that that's where it all began. And the forward-thinking and the enlightened people, the theologians and the thinkers, they're saying that doesn't make sense anymore. Why do we hold on to that? So I like what you said. We do have to be careful because it comes to a point. Again, does that really matter? Because it's the greatest mystery, Paula, like you just said. Be a virgin, not a virgin, is still an incredible, awesome, universal mystery.
Well, and I think one of the things, too, that have come, just several points I want to make. One is that, you know, one reason, too, that people believe in the hold on to the virgin birth is because classical Christianity holds this teaching of original sin, that we're all born somehow stained with the sin of Adam. And so, you know, I've heard people say, well, if, you know, according to the Bible, sin came through Adam, and so sin comes through the human father, and you know, and if Jesus had a human father, he would have been stained with original sin, and on and on and on. So there's that. And then the other thing, though, is that the other thing I was thinking about, some of the things you were saying, Paul, and I don't mean to get graphic on the air here, but it's something you said that I thought was interesting. You were talking about how people have unfortunately thought that somehow the sex act was dirty, and I you know, it just occurred to me something really obvious. I think that maybe one of the reasons people think the sex act was dirty is because, you know, people use sex organs are also the same organs people use to go to the bathroom. So probably why people, you know, instinctively thought it was dirty. And we, you know, of course we know better and we know it's not, but it's just something I was thinking of, that maybe that was one of the reasons why people originally had that belief. The thing is, though, going back to the incarnation, you know, Jesus is truly human and truly divine. And, you know, in order to be truly human, you know, he had to have two parents. And you know, that's, I think, and I guess that's really, to me, the issue. You know, the issue is that, you know, there is no original sin. There's none of that. We don't have to worry about that. So, you know, again, Jesus was fully God and fully man. And part of being fully man is, you know, being born the way everybody else is born.
You know, at the same time, I was listening to all of you and I was asking Jesus, if you were here with us, Jesus, what would you like us to say? And the thought that ran through my mind was, that maybe what we should focus on is more the religion of the spirit than the religion of the mind. If we talk about the religion of the mind, which has been, as it says, man-made, we will argue until we're blue in the face, and we will never see eye to eye the whole world, the whole planet, the whole brotherhood of man, humanity. But if we focus on the true message of Jesus, which is the religion of the spirit, then we're talking about a whole new different thing. And to follow what you were reading, Paula, a few sentences in the next paper, I remember that it said, Jesus wanted to appear as an average man so that the common people would understand him and receive him. So he was, as we say, you folks in English, you say he walked the talk. He did exactly what he wanted us to know. So he started as an average man, was born by an average couple, Joseph and Mary, lived his life as a human Jesus to the point of his baptism when his divinity took over, and then he started his public ministry with his divineness, you know, his divinity. But at the same time, the message is the religion of the spirit. And this religion of the mind, the theology of religion, will always argue about semantics, about terminology, about certain understandings that we among ourselves, it's just like, to me sometimes I feel it's like we're little kids trying to, I'm not trying to put anybody down, I'm just saying humanity as a whole, a collective entity, it's almost like a childlike discussion as opposed to a more mature realization, and especially from as far as we've come. Technologically, we like to say that we're so advanced. Well, we should be advanced as well. And even life is forcing us in a certain way to become advanced on the spirit level as well as on the matter or the physical, material level. We only have to look at what's happening not only in the United States, but in the world right now, economically wise, politically wise, even religiously wise, to see that we need to focus on spirit and we need to attune ourselves to maybe a higher version, a higher vision as well, and to understand that certain important values may reside more in the religion of the spirit than the religion of the mind. That's the thought I had.
You know, I think that, for me, one of the most precious things about the Urantia book, and especially about the life and teachings of Jesus, is that it gave us the human Jesus back. We had the divine Jesus, and all of Christianity pretty much is honed in on the divine Jesus. And a lot of these things we've been talking about, like the virgin birth, those are all, you know, they keep Jesus mystical and apart from us. But the Urantia book gives him back to us in full measure, his true humanity. He was not just God. He was God and man.
Right.
He is both God and man. Man is an experiential possession of Christ Michael, the sovereign of Nebadon. And so, to me, that humanity of Jesus is what touches me most deeply, because I know when I am sorrowful, he has been sorrowful. He drank deeply of the cup of human sorrow, right? He wept. He, in all things, even as I am, he was tried and tested. And most likely, I will never be, you know, drawn up on trumped up charges and crucified. That's never going to happen to me. He was the most misunderstood, and yet he was as clear as a bell. Never was there a human being more clear and more sincere and more honest in his approach to his humanity than Jesus, and yet he was the most misunderstood human that's ever lived on the planet. And I think it's because of who he was. But the notion that God doing things in the normal and natural way. To me, there is such beauty in that statement that they make there that I read because, and I just want to share a little story. When I was in Israel in 1994, we had a wonderful tour guide. His name was Anis, and he was a scholar. His father, a true scholar, his father actually held the Dead Sea Scrolls in his hands, and they passed through his father. You know, he was a dealer in antiquities, and Anis would say things like, you know, as we drove along on our bus, scholars typically say this and that, but I say, you know, and I used to think, wow, this guy's got my attention because he has enough confidence in his own knowledge to make a statement like that. And he got to where he really loved this book. Every day we would go to some place in the Holy Land that was just so poignant to us, and we would read from the book what the book had to say about that place. And Anis got to where he just really loved. He couldn't wait to hear the next, you know, chapter from the book about where we were going. And this particular day, we were going to Caesarea Philippi, and it's right nearby the headwaters of the Jordan. And from there, we went up on Mount Hermon. And he said, I want to tell you what I believe about why Jesus took his apostles through this place and then up to the mountain when he told them, "What does God? Who do men say that I am?" And he said, I'd like to hear what your book has to say about that. And so when we got there, we looked at this great, you know, the beautiful headwaters of the Jordan. We read about this place from the book, and Anise told us, that is the most beautiful description of the place that we are going that I have ever heard. And when we got there, here it was a Roman, little enclave, and here's this wall with these niches, this giant rock wall with these niches carved out, and Anise told us that these niches at one point held a statue of a Roman god. And then when he took us up on Mount Hermon, Anise, our guide, he told us, he said, you see, I believe that Jesus took the apostles through this place and showed them the gods of stone and then asked them, and who do you say that I am? And Peter stood up and said, you're the Son of the living God. And Jesus said, no man told you that, right? You guys remember this story, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you see, I believe he did that to show the apostles the difference between the dead gods of stone and the living God.
That's right.
Who touches his children where they live, as they live. Jesus was a real human being who could go down in the mines. He was a boat maker. He was a tent maker. He was a caravan maker. He hung out at the crossroads of the world and spoke many languages and touched people where they live. He hugged and he held and he cried and he felt because he was real, a real man. And God, to me, that's the beauty of that, what I read when it says that God does things in the normal way, the natural way. And the other side of that is that when you're hurting, oftentimes, most often, it's another human who will come and minister to you or me.
Exactly.
And that's how that works.
And that brings us to, if I can say, to me the most crucial message about to answer Andre's question about the birth of Jesus and the beautiful word you use, Paula, the bestowal of Jesus on earth. To me, that was the very end of a time and the beginning of a new time in humanity's time. And that is that with the birth of Jesus, we actually now with the Urantia book, we have the true recounting of the human divine life of Jesus, and he came as a model to show us our human divine nature. And as I said at ICO8 in California this summer, this HD mode, the human divine mode, you know, when you remember when I said people tell us about machinery and, I have the high definition mode, or you listen to Entertainment Tonight in high definition mode. I feel like saying, well, we have the highest definition mode, which is the human divine mode. That's way beyond machinery. And that human divine mode comes from the visit of Jesus on earth. And that highest definition mode, it's the Homo Deus. Homo Deus, which means exactly what our master was, the model of the man God. The difference is that he was God incarnating himself in man, and we are man progressing back toward God. So at the same time, we remember in history, when we look in the dictionary, we see the three phases. The first phase was Homo Erectus, when man stood up, when man erected himself, and we know that it's Andon and Fonta that gave birth to the phase, the physical man, Homo Erectus. And then we went into Homo Sapiens, the thinking man, the era of the mind, and the mindal man, or the mental man. And now we are at the very beginning of Homo Deus, which is the long progressing ascent toward the beginning of light and life. And Jesus just came to give us the recipe book, the model. Just follow after me. Don't copy me, but use me as a model. And then because they do tell us there dwells within the human mind a fragment of God, but there also sojourns with the human soul the spirit of truth, the spirit of Jesus. So because Jesus is 100% directly connected with our soul, all we've got to do is know his life and teachings and then follow him and use him as a guide in our heart and soul, and we've got it made. We just got to progress, and one by one, it will start until we reach light and life. But some, to me, some people are already living in a state of light and life, so there is our responsibility to help our brothers and sisters move toward that homo deus. That is not to pretend we are God, but to say that we are child of God, a son of God, absolutely. That is our true nature. So that doesn't take away our human side. We make mistakes, we do all that. But to at least know that we have this divinity within us that's just waiting to be turned on like a switch. Please just turn me on and then let me do the work, and together you and I are going to have the greatest time progressing toward divinity. So I just wanted to say this, that it's the third phase of, if we look in the long spectrum of cosmic progression, we are in this homo deus time at the very beginning, through the, and it started with Jesus.
Makes perfect sense to me, Diane. I think I told you that. I have a friend who had the exact same concept, only he calls it homo divinicus.
Right.
And he's a Rancho Book reader, too. He came up with the exact same concept, the next phase, HD. It's still HD, though. I thought that was really interesting.
Hi, I'd like to go back to the birth of Jesus, though, for a minute, because I want to ask, one thing that people tend to believe, a lot of Christians believe, that Jesus was born in a manger. Is that true?
Yes.
Okay. That's why I can't remember what the Urantia book said about
Yes. That. Yes. I just read it at 4 o'clock this morning, and yes, it is. He was born in a manger.
Now, someone gave them a room. Was it the next day or 2 days later?
No, actually, when Joseph appeared and arrived with Mary in Bethlehem, it was for the census, and all the inns were taken, and there was a place underneath a manger where the people at the inn said, look, it's been emptied, it's been cleaned, it's been made ready to receive people, and they say that Joseph and Mary counted themselves very fortunate to have a place to sleep, and it was not the stable where they had the animals, but it was the manger where they kept the grain, and they had curtains and everything, and that's where, with the help of other women, Mary gave birth to Jesus, and they say that the three magi, or the three wise men, were not there.
No, they weren't there yet. It was three.
They weren't there yet, and they actually moved the next day.
Right.
They moved into a hotel room, an inn room of someone who accepted to change place with Joseph and Mary, and then they stayed there for about 10 days.
Yeah, I thought that's what I remembered, that they moved into a regular room, right?
Yes.
Yeah, because when you see these depictions of being with animals, but again, that's okay. You know, it's a beautiful scene. I have a manger scene right now. I say that. Mine, I deliberately picked it out a long time ago. There are no animals around, and they're actually like, there's a little, behind them, there's a little window and a room. For me, you know, that speaks to me personally. But, you know, I want to go back about, we as your Rancho Book readers, we really are embarking on a great adventure here. I see in the chat room there's someone that's come in that's not familiar with the Rancho Book, and someone came in and left. So we are talking to people, and they're listening to us that have no idea what we're talking about. And we need to be, this is a school. Paula, I told you that, Andre, that I really believe, and I put this in an email, that this is a new format for a school on the Internet, and what a great way. The early church, the early Christians, let's review quickly what went wrong there and what can we learn from those early believers that we can choose in our group consciousness to not make those same mistakes. Why, like, for example, as you know, I asked the question, Andre, you don't know this, Diane, I started asking the question because we've had a celebration of all the bestowals. Who do you say that he is? And I asked this of people of several different religions. And we need to hear that. And because if we're not careful, you know, the comfort zone is to sort of follow the same pattern of what's already here and what already began. These people are not going to hear the glad tidings of the fatherhood, brotherhood, if we continue to stay on that track. So I ask the question, what can we learn from the early church and not make the same mistake?
Well, I read somewhere that apparently the apostles, I mean, I'm only saying what I read because I wasn't there but at the time, but I read that the original proclamation of the apostles was truer to the true message of Jesus, and it was to talk about this spirit dwelling within each and every one of us and to rejoice because we were part of this whole family, that God is our Father and the Father of all. And this intrinsically makes us all brothers and sisters. So, Anne, to listen to your question, to me, I think it's important to put focus on that because along the way, within centuries, there may have been deviations, but if we look at and read what the original sayings of the apostles and the teachings of the apostles were, they were simple, they were communing, they were fraternizing with one another. It seemed to be simple and, as Jesus said, full of joy, you know, and because it was word of mouth as opposed to sitting down and reading 5,000 pages of manuscript, it was more into the living, you know, and the understanding, bearing those fruits of the Spirit that Jesus kept talking about so much, you know. It's in the proof is in the pudding. So when they were living together, helping one another, understanding, and going the second mile, I think they were very close to his teaching.
Well, what happened?
I think there are a couple things. One is, well, first of all, I want to go back to something that you were saying, Diana, before about the religion of the mind as opposed to the religion of the spirit. And I don't think that we need to. I don't think I'm contradicting what you're saying here, but I think we actually need both. Because Jesus tells us to love our God with our heart, soul, and mind. So, and the Urantia book is worded very precisely. One of the reasons that so many Urantia book readers get into arguments about what the book is saying is because the book is worded very precisely. The book does not bypass our intellect at all. I mean, the book is a very intellectual mm-hmm. book. It's not just intellectual, but it deals with our hearts and our minds. But one of the things that that I think is interesting, we talk about theological debates. And some of the theological debates are, are silly. Some of them are, you know, how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. But some of the theological debates in the early church were actually very important. And I think one of the most important debates was, one of the things that was extremely important in the early church was what's called Christology, which is how we view Jesus. How do we view Christ? Is Christ all human or all divine or half human or half divine? That was the big debate in the early church. And the Urantia book actually says, that at the bottom of page 2070 in the original Foundation edition, it says that it talks about what is known as the Arian heresy. And the Arian heresy was formulated by a guy named Arius. Arius said that that Jesus was subordinate to the Father, and he was not exactly like the Father. He was similar to the Father, but he really wasn't exactly like the Father. And the Urantia book says that Athanasius, who was a believer stood up and refuted Arius, and the Urantia book says that if it wasn't for the logic and eloquence of this believer, the truth about Jesus would have been lost to the world. So I do think that there are some theological debates that are important, but I think, to answer your question, Anne, what happened? I think one of the things that happened, and I was thinking about this, is we had Mark Siljandra on the air before, who has been dialoguing with Muslims. Maybe what I think maybe the big mistake was I mean, I'm very glad we have Christianity because I've been nourished by Christianity, but that really wasn't what Jesus came here for. He didn't come here to start a new religion. So as Urantia book readers, we don't need to start a new religion. We don't need to tell people, well, you need to stop being Christians, or you need to stop being Jews, or you need to stop being Buddhists in order to read the Urantia book. We need to help people figure out a way, facilitate how they can integrate the teachings of the Urantia book into their own existing religious system. And I think that's really what's important, because you know, we don't need to, it's like I said to someone recently a couple days ago, Jesus is more important than Christianity. So, you know, Jesus was, you know, the teachings of Jesus are meant to be a heritage for all religions. So if we can help people, you know, integrate the teachings of Jesus into their own existing religious system so that they don't feel like they're being converted to something else, I think that could be one of the greatest things we could do.
Hear, hear, Andre. Hear, hear. That's beautiful. And you know what you're saying there about the mind, it is a balance. And
yeah.
The early church, it, those writings actually that cause people to think about it, because in the beginning, that apostolic council, you know, around 49 or 50, and they saw itself as a worldwide religion. And Paul depicted a lively community, was diverse and had giftings and many social stratas. The only ritual they had in common was the baptism and the Lord's Supper. But then there was a severe disagreement started coming in. You see it in the writings in how to translate this life and these teachings into consistent behavior, you know, like a moral code of living. The idealistic view is presented by in the book of Acts, you know, where they were in perfect unity. Of course, they had sold everything they had. Y'all remember that. They lived in common. And then you come in and you start picking up on the divisions that started coming in. Why? Because they're finding, in like in Turkey, for example, I just saw a DVD about this. They've discovered in a city of Turkey these ancient ruins where it was obvious that early Christians lived. They were, but the way they lived it out with their rituals was according to the Greek tradition. Whereas in other parts, they were bringing in their own way of doing it. So, Andre, what you're saying, as people slowly decide to read the Urantia book, and they're from totally different parts of the world, like the Chinese that I ask, who do you say that he is? No concept. He said, I never heard of him. He's 40 years old. He said, I'd never heard this about this man Jesus until I met you in early March. That's the Great Wall of China. Did anybody go to China in the early church? I know Nathaniel went to India, and then a couple of them went to Africa, right? But with the others, they stayed primarily in the Greco-Roman world back then, Ephesus and that area. And this place in Turkey, you could see Ephesus, where Paul ended up. So we do have to drop our walls. I love what you said, Andre. You don't have to convert to read this book. It's going to manifest in many ways in people's lives. And I know it was a great challenge for me to introduce the book to the Interfaith Council that I've sat on since 1995, knowing all these diverse minds. And as I shared with you in the email, I used this broadcast. I went back and listened to several shows, and I teased them. I said, I feel like I need lifelines as I make this presentation because of the diversity in this room. And then away I did have lifelines. I took y'all with me. I took the ones that I went back and listened. Diane, I listened to you. I listened to Chris. You know, many others. I was in overload, and I was very thankful for it. So,
you know, I have to get back, though, Anne, to your original question, and because I think it's an important question about how do we keep from falling into the same traps as we move forward as religionists. And you guys made the point that, you know, I think the book says it is your thoughts, not your feelings, that lead you Godward. And Jesus also said, the intellect is not the seat of the spirit, but it is indeed the gateway thereto. So there's the same concept said in two different ways.
Gateway,
your
yeah.
thoughts, not your feelings, that lead you Godward. However, you don't want to get stuck in the gateway. You want to go on through the gateway
yeah.
into the spirit. Okay, but I want to address your question, Anne, and I think that it's really, really important. What the Urantia book does for us is it shows us, in a cosmic sense, how we came to be behind in our spiritual development and why it is that we would fall into these traps. And as I view us from, you know, I think the beautiful thing about it is it gives us a view of ourselves, as my good old friend Mo would say, from 60,000 feet. But it's a much larger perspective on our human condition, because when we're here on this planet and it's most difficult and we can't see the forest for the trees in some respects, what I see is that the greatest detriment that ever happened to us as a world was losing Adam and Eve, losing our mother and father. They were our universe representatives. They were like the pilot of this good ship, Urantia, and they would have guided us away from some of the evil shoals that we keep wrecking this beautiful craft on. And because we're just children, we can't help it. It's like mother and father. You know, a child can probably grow up without a mother and father, but we all know that it's going to be really, really difficult for that child to avoid some of the pitfalls that mother and father would help that child avoid, most of them. Mother and father would help that child avoid and steer that child clear of those pitfalls. We all know that that child's going to make mistakes, but there are some mistakes that that child doesn't have to make. Well, Urantia has no mother and father, and so we are just destined to get blindsided many times. And the story of Jesus, the early Christians made that mistake. And as I read the book, as I read the authors of the book are celestial, I believe it with all my heart. Their wisdom, their love, their insight, their foresight just comes through so strongly. And the midwares, the authors of the Jesus papers, you know, they lament sometimes. You just feel how they lament that, you know, of course, Jesus tried to tell the apostles, you know, what his mission was, and his kingdom was not of this world. And you know, great concepts that are beyond this world in a sense. And yet they fell right into the trap of making a religion about him, and it became about the risen and glorified Christ. And that's one of those instances, I think, where without somebody here to constantly guide us to say, no, don't go there. It's like when Adam first arrived and the people of the world wanted to fall down on their face and worship him, and he had to constantly tell them, no, don't worship me. You know, it's because we are just children, just babes in a spiritual sense, and so we're going to make these mistakes. And
yeah.
We as Urantia Book readers, we have a great revelation of truth that tells us all the pitfalls, but we're still going to fall into making some of these same mistakes.
Well, and you know what? And you know what, Paula? And we need to take a break here in a minute and go into our Ministry of the Month feature. But before we do, I'd like to say, I actually think, and this is kind of another one of my controversial statements here, but I think sometimes, readers, we go to the other extreme with the religion of Jesus. I hear some readers, they're so worried about creating a religion about Jesus, they don't want to talk about Jesus. They're like, oh, we just have to talk about the Father of God and Brother of Man, but we don't want to talk about Jesus. Well, obviously, if Jesus is important, otherwise the book wouldn't give us 800 pages about him, you know, about his life. So we need to be careful that we don't fall in the other trap, the other extreme either. The other thing I want to say is I don't know if this is what you were referring to, Anne, because I couldn't hear you very well, and part of it's the position I'm in. I need to probably get into a different position here. But you know, there was an early, as far as not forcing people to convert to a new religion. There's a term for that in the New Testament. It's called Judaizing. There were people who were trying to tell Christians that people who wanted to become Christians that they had to become Jews first, and they had to get circumcised before they could become Christians. They were telling Gentiles that, and Paul spoke vehemently against that. And he said, "No, you know, don't do that to people." In fact, Paul even went so far as to say, "You know, these people who are requiring circumcision, I hope they, you know, let the knife slip and emasculate themselves." I mean, Paul was really upset, you know. He really did not like this at all. And so, you know, I think this is where, you know, again, and it's really interesting because, you know, there's a movement within Christianity called Jews for Jesus, and they tell Jews, you don't have to stop being Jews. You can still celebrate your old Jewish holidays. And I was thinking about this. What if we had Muslims for Jesus, and Buddhists for Jesus, and Hindus for Jesus? Wouldn't that be something?
Actually, that's very interesting what you're saying, Andre, because as I was listening to you, I realized that in my mind there's a difference between the Christ and Christian. The Christ, to me, applies to everybody on the planet Earth, called Urantia. As Christian is more like a sect, a group, the Christian group, and so it becomes, you know, like a reserved group of people. But when we think of the Christ is relates to all of us And his name was Jesus Christ. It was not Jesus the Christian. Christian is what we've made it of over the years, over the centuries, the millennium. But Christ is Jesus, physical Christ, mindful, Michael, spiritual. That's his true name. So when we relate to, if we connect with our spirit within, then I hope you don't get me wrong. When I spoke about the religion of the mind before, I didn't mean to subtract the mind from the factor of life. I mean, I do understand that we communicate through the mind. But on the opposite, there is the purpose to purify our mind, to me, to get a purified thought. A thought, when they say, when you can't think, think with the mind of Jesus. Or
mm-hmm.
we can exchange together. You know, I was talking more about the religion of the mind that has created wars, that has created arguments, you know, that
well, I think that's what the answer calls the religion of authority or the religion of fear.
Yes.
You know, those two kinds. But we do need to take a break here, and we're going to play for you our little brief segment of an interview that I did with Mo Siegel. We're going to talk a little bit about truthbook.com. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Andre Traversa, co-host and producer of the Cosmic Citizen Radio Show. With me on the phone today is Mo Siegel. Mo Siegel is the current president of the Urantia Foundation. He's been a trustee with the foundation for 10 years. He is also the founder of the Jesusonian Foundation and is also the founder of Truthbook.com. Truthbook.com is one of the premier websites for the dissemination of the teachings of the Urantia Revelation. Welcome to the Cosmic Citizen, Mo.
Thank you.
Mo, what was the... You know, there are a lot of websites out there about, you know, about the Urantia book. But what was the impetus? What was the thing that kind of got you motivated to start truthbook.com?
Well, truthbook.com is different than Urantia Foundation's website, which really represents the whole book. And the fellowship's website, which is a really wonderful study tool. Truthbook.com was designed to go after a particular market, first and foremost, and that was a market of searching Christians that wanted to find new teachings. Now, Truthbook covers the entire book, but its greatest emphasis is on part four of the book, even though, of course, we have lots of stuff on the whole book in there. But we wanted a searching Christian that wanted new answers, new faith answers, to find out about the Urantia book in a way that they would remain open-minded when they came to something as unusual as the Urantia book teachings. And I highly encourage people that feel there should be something like this for Hinduism or Buddhism or Islam or Judaism, build a website that targets a certain market. The real joy we've had, Andre, with Truthbook over the years is it is visual. Lots of audio, video, pictures, thousands of pictures, quote of the day. We're illustrating part four of the book. It's a real attempt to use 21st century multimedia in expressing the Urantia book's teachings, and in a way that if you're a long-time dedicated reader, you can be filled with information. And if you're a brand new person, we hope that we've opened the door in a way that people will want to learn more. You can't show somebody the beauty of the temple if you can't get them in the door, and our hope is to get them in the door.
Mm.
Thank you, Mo Siegel. That was our little segment of our interview with Mo Siegel, and we'll be continuing to play another segment of that next week. And again, anybody who's interested, please go to truthbook.com. It's a great website. It's a great resource. There's all kinds of tools on there. I don't even know what all the stuff that's available on there. I'm sure, Paul, you're probably more familiar with it than I am. In fact, I know you are. That's one of the ones that usually comes up when I do a Google search on a paper or something. Is usually Truthbook. What is it? What do you like about Truthbook, Paula?
Well, I think I told you that Truthbook was actually the. It was precursed by, if that's a word, I'm not sure, but the first site was Jesusonian.org, and Larry, our board manager and our producer, Larry Watkins, and I worked on that together, and then sometime later we were able to convince Mo that this was the greatest opportunity going to spread the teachings of the Urantia book, and or Moby came convinced anyway, and he decided to get involved, and that kicked it up to a whole nother level, as you might imagine, because that's just the way Mo is. He strives for excellence. But our whole mission in creating Truth Book was to create a bastion where people could go and find the beautiful truths of the Urantia book and find them in a place that they would be easily accessible and beautiful. And Mo and I always thought that the revelators who gave us the revelation gave us the truth and goodness and left the beauty part up to us. So we have that great joy of adding imagery and art and, you know, beauty to the revelation music.
And isn't it a meaningful coincidence, you guys, that as you noticed that Mo in the interview said exactly what I just said a few minutes ago. He said, if anybody out there thinks that something like this could work for Buddhists or Hindus or Muslims, this is just what I was saying a few minutes ago about Buddhists for Jesus or Muslims for Jesus, you know. So I want to turn the corner here and talk about the second part of our discussion, which is what are the implications of the incarnation? What does it mean that God became man? And I just want to just throw out some thoughts, because one of the things that, you know, it's funny, I got to tell you guys, I love Christmas carols. I love them. And I wish I could find some Christmas music that was royalty-free that we could play. Unfortunately, a lot of the Christmas music out there is either not royalty-free or it's just really not very good. It's stuff that people, you know, did on their home recorders or whatever that just doesn't sound that great. But there's some great theology in Christmas carols. One of my favorite ones is Hark the Herald Angels Sing. There's a place where it says, veiled in flesh the Godhead see, hail the incarnate deity. It's just, oh, it's just beautiful. Or it says, born to raise the sons of earth, born to give them second birth. I mean, I think a lot of people don't realize what they're singing when they say these things. And maybe that's okay. Maybe it sinks into their unconscious anyway. But, you know, it's just so, some of this stuff is so great. But one of the songs that I think is unfortunate is a part in Away in the Manger where it says, the little Lord Jesus, no crying he makes. Well, you and I both all know that that's not true. Jesus cried as a baby. In fact, I want to take the opportunity to mention another song. It's not a Christmas carol, but it's something that, it's a song that I think just was so, so enjoyable and so interesting. There was a song that came out in 1996, actually no, in late 1995, by a lady named Joan Osborne. And the song was called What If God Was One of Us? And I don't know if you guys have, I know some of you have heard the song. I know that Diane has, because you and I talked about it. But
I love it.
Yeah, and the lyrics go like this. It says, what if God was one of us? Just a slob like one of us. Just a stranger on the bus trying to make his way home. And, you know, it's so funny because I sang this song in 1996 at a karaoke night at a club, okay? And it was interesting because I did something, it was a really, really amazing moment, actually, in my life, because I don't think I'll ever see these, I may not ever see these people again that were at this karaoke bar until maybe the Imagine World, because I don't know whatever happened to them, but I was singing this song. And then during the guitar solo part, this is right before Christmas. It was the 23rd of December, right before Christmas. And I said, you know what? God did become one of us 2,000 years ago. And I don't mean to be irreverent, but I said, you know what? God went to the bathroom. God passed gas. God had bad breath. God had body odor. God, you know. And I said, and then I said, you know what? That's why we celebrate Christmas, because God became one of us. And everybody just cheered, and they just went crazy, you know. But, I mean, you know, again, I don't mean to be irreverent, but what I'm trying to say here is really true. Jesus really became human in all the beauty and ugliness of humanity, and all that entails, and all the glorious, wonderful imperfection. Of course, he didn't sin, but he was everything that we are. I mean, it says in the book of Hebrews, that he was tempted at all points like we are. There are a couple other Bible verses I want to point out before you guys talk. I just want to say, one is 1 Corinthians 1:26, I think. It says, the foolishness of God is wiser than human wisdom, and the weakness of God is stronger than human strength. Now, how does that relate to the incarnation? I think it relates to the incarnation because, you know, to the world, you know, this is the foolishness of God. I mean, how foolish it is for God. Why would God want to come as a helpless baby, you know, and be weak and helpless and passive? Why would, when God could demonstrate, you know, great power by, you know, but what does it say in the Old Testament? It says that it's not by power, not by might, not by power, but by my spirit, says the Lord. The other thing I want to do, the other verse I want to just point out is Philippians 2. I don't remember the exact verses, but it says that Jesus did not think equality with God a thing to be grasped, but he came down and made himself nothing and submitted himself even unto, and took the form of a servant and submitted himself unto death, even to death on the cross. And so what does it say? It says he emptied himself. It says he came down and made himself nothing. So Jesus divested himself of his divine attributes. You know, this, the most powerful being in the universe became the most powerless being in the universe. I mean, what are the implications of all this? Any thoughts from anybody?
Well, I think we should let Anne or Diane answer that question.
Well, it's interesting because as you were talking, Andre, I had this beautiful vision run through my mind, and as you were talking about the human Jesus and you were putting so much focus and emphasis, and it, with your beautiful voice, it sounded like so believable, you know. And it was this vision I had in my mind that if we want to spiritualize ourselves, it was like, you know, a seesaw. You know, when you go on a seesaw with someone and you sit, and the higher you are, the lower the other one is. And do you understand what I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm.
So the vision I had was that the more we want to spiritualize ourselves, the more we need to see the human Jesus, to know the human Jesus, because that is the way. So we want, we all want, we hear it from everywhere, you know, people are talking about spirituality, spirituality, spirituality. Well, the more we want to raise ourselves in spirituality, the more we need to see the human side of Jesus and to know the human side of Jesus, so that we use that as a counterpart, as a model to model from, to help us raise ourselves. We're not going to spiritualize ourselves or divinize ourselves just out of the blue like that. You know, the cosmos is not chaos. It's organized. So he is that organization, and he is that model of humanity that if we keep emulating him, then we have a chance to get this beautiful wind, you know, behind our wings to make us raise in spirituality and still remain so human, you know, so tangible, so accessible. And this is the human, this is the Jesus that I love, because at the same time, when you were talking about that song, Andre, I loved it. I remember when it was a number one on the hit parade, and I was sitting there sometimes in the bus or in the subway thinking, geez, I wonder if Jesus came back today, I wonder how many one of us would recognize him, how many of us would follow him, how many of us would understand him, how many of us would unconditionally love him, how many of us would see through him. So, you know, sometimes we think it would be so much more different, but I just wonder how much more different. I think the change comes from within. It comes one at a time, and then it goes another one, another one, and another one, as opposed to the reverse.
Well, I think that's absolutely true, Diane, and a very beautiful point. And, you know, I, as I said earlier, I love to ponder Jesus' humanity. But because it shows us ever an example of how we, just regular humans like us, can treat each other. And early on, Andre, you mentioned, or maybe it was Diane, I can't remember, one of you mentioned the difference between the religion of the spirit and the religions of the mind, or as Jesus would call them, the religions of authority. And the religion of the spirit will draw us closer together.
Mm-hmm.
The honor, and I know, Anne, this is dear to your heart because you're an interfaither from way back. And, of course, the Urantia book is an interfaith book. It was, you know, keeping in mind that it was written in 1934 and 1935 before anybody was really that interested in interfaith. But it admonishes us to honor the spiritual path of every person. And it says things like you would do better to borrow from the best of your fellow, your neighbor's religious beliefs than to denounce the worst of their outworn traditions. And I think that's so important that we be able to do that so that we can learn. Because for me, the religion of Jesus, which the Urantia book makes this classic distinction between the religion about Jesus and the religion of Jesus. The religion of Jesus is the religion of a spiritual ambassador. It's a universal religion. If we could be transported to heaven right now, what religion would those beings in that beautiful place be practicing? It would be the religion of the Spirit, the religion, as Jesus described it, a personal religious experience, which honors that there is no way, since we are holy, each one of us is a holy, unique being, there is no way we will ever come to complete unity of thought, but we can come to unity of spirit.
And you haven't said much for a while, so I'd like to give you a chance to talk. Tell us what your thoughts are on the incarnation. When you think about God becoming man, what comes to your mind?
Is Anne here? Hello, Anne?
I don't know what happened there.
Oh, she lost her voice for a minute. Anne?
Hello?
No wonder.
Hello?
Anne?
Hi.
Hello?
What the heck happened there?
Are you there, Anne?
Yeah.
Okay. I asked you a question. Did you hear it?
Can you hear me now?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, I guess we're in a parallel universe again. I was talking, and Paula and Diane, I would start talking, and y'all would just start talking, and I thought, these guys aren't hearing me.
Somehow you dropped off.
Sorry, Anne. I didn't hear you. I'm sorry.
No, I know that, because we're all, you know.
We were missing you.
You must have a lot of missing.
Y'all,
I know.
Y'all weren't hearing me? Paula, do you see I wrote on the board, I'm here.
I just saw you, indeed, precious voice, and I'm like, wait a minute.
Anne's
here, but she's not talking. What's going on?
Well, Larry had commented how wonderful Diane's accent is. And so I wrote, indeed, and I misspelled everything. This multitasking is interesting. I said, indeed, a precious voice. And I thought about the contrast in the accents on the broadcast. I think that's wonderful.
Oh, say thank you to Larry. Send him my love.
Larry, hello. Okay.
I had asked you a question. I don't know if you heard me. We've been talking a little bit about the incarnation and about, you know, what does it mean that God became man? When you think about the incarnation, what comes to your mind?
Well, first of all, I always think about how the incarnation changed the world as humankind knew it.
Mm-hmm.
That there was a, regardless of belief system, what I have discovered with interfaith communities, there's a deep awareness, something was unique about this man, whether or not they acknowledge him as simply a human, a good teacher, a moral teacher, a prophet, a divine supernatural being. And, of course, you know, the Muslims believe that he started speaking the moment he was born. Now, that gives him, you know, in some of the apocryphal literature, have him performing miracles even as a child. And the implications, and I'm struggling with the use of that word, I believe the implications are well illustrated in the great Christmas carols that Larry wrote on the board. What did Larry write about that? He said the old traditional hymns are exceptionally perceptive, and I agree with him. And he commented about Ave Maria being one of his favorite songs.
Mm.
And I want to share with you some insight. I don't know if y'all know this. I didn't know this till recently. You're not supposed to really sing most Christmas carols until Christmas Eve. There's a liturgy that rolls out, you know, in the churches, And I talked to my Methodist minister about it, and I've talked to the Greek Orthodox and Catholic. Now, the Greek Orthodox and the Catholic follow the line as far as I could read to you some of their songs. It's a proclamation of something is about to happen. But, and here's, I'll read this to you. This is the Greek Orthodox. This is the forecast, forthcoming hymn that is chanted 40 days prior to December 25th. Now, you're going to hear some words about Virgin, and we'll move past that, right? The Savior's most pure and immaculate temple, the very precious bridal chamber and Virgin, who is the sacred treasure of the glory of God, on this day is introduced into the house of the Lord, and with herself she brings the grace of the divine spirit. She is extolled by the angels of God, a heavenly tabernacle is she. And so I just wanted to share that with you, that Silent Night and O Little Town of Bethlehem, liturgy says don't sing those, but you know, the Protestant churches have said, you know, that we want to enjoy those wonderful hymns or those wonderful carols. Andre, you don't know this, but I was asked last week suddenly by a Sikh priest, a Sikh Gyanaji, as we call him, marvelous man, 69 years old, just out of nowhere. He said, "What is a Christmas carol?" He had heard it on a radio show, and I said, "A carol?" You know. So I explained, and he said he called his wife into what we would call the sanctuary, and he said, "Would you sing one of these for us?" Well, my mind just went blah 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 blah, you know. Well, suddenly Silent Night, and I sang Silent Night, and I gave each one of them a handmade cross that evening, and they were very thankful. And because I sang Silent Night in Bethlehem when there was only 12 of us there. I was with the media, and we'd been invited back by the mayor, and a little cafe was open for us. And we were leaving the little town, well, it's not so little now, but the town of Bethlehem. There was nobody on the street. So we stood there and sang Silent Night. So my mind went back to Bethlehem, and when I finished singing and I opened my eyes, they were both visibly moved by this experience. And he said, "What a beautiful song. I feel like I'm actually experiencing his birth in this moment." I said, "Sir, that's because I actually sang that in Bethlehem when nobody was around." So I hope I've answered your question, Andre. I'm not sure if I've answered your question.
Well, I think the first part, you said something that right away that just really made me think. You were talking about how the incarnation changed the world and how a lot of people, even people who are not Christians, understand that there was something unique about Jesus. And, you know, if you really think about it, there have been some books written about this, actually. One is called What If Jesus Had Never Been Born? And the other one, I can't remember the name of it. But basically, the point of some of these books is, you know, I don't think we realize we take for granted a lot of the things we have, a lot of the blessings we have in our civilization that come from the teachings of Jesus. I mean, for example, the fact that Jesus loved children so much. You know, the Romans and some of the Greeks laughed at the early Christians because the early Christians, when they had unwanted children or handicapped children, the pagans would leave those children to die. You know, they would leave them to the elements, and they would just leave them alone. They would just leave them to die. And I think that there are things that we take for granted today that I think are really a product of the teachings of Jesus. You know, children's hospitals, orphanages, a spirit of charity. Now, I realize that, you know, there were hospitals in Greece, you know, we had Hippocrates and things like that. But just the value that we place on helping the needy, the value that we place on service, the value that we place on, of course we need to increase the value we place on those things, but to the extent that we place the value on those things, you know, they come from the teachings of Jesus. The fact that we have laws about, you know, treating people humanely, all those things, you know, we are reaping the benefits of the capital, you know, that came from the teachings of Jesus. So I think that's...
No, Andre, you're making such an incredible point, I think, and there's something that I keep on my desk, and we have a caller, and I'd like to take our caller in just a second, but I want to share this with you guys because this thing inspires me so deeply, and I'm sure it was written by a Christian, but it is so inspiring, and it really makes you think. It's called One Solitary Life. You may have heard it before, but it goes, he was born in an obscure village. He worked in a carpenter shop until he was 30. He then became an itinerant preacher. He never held an office. He never had a family or owned a house. He didn't go to college. He had no credentials but himself. 20 centuries have come and gone, and today he is the central figure of the human race. All the armies that ever marched, all the navies that ever sailed, all the parliaments that ever sat, and all the kings that ever reigned have not affected the life of man on this earth as much as that one solitary life.
Yay!
Isn't that beautiful?
Yay! Love it.
And who's our caller here?
Okay, hold on. It's Crystalline. I know by the number. Hello, Crystalline.
Well, you just totally stole my thunder, Paula. It's just rather serendipitous, but that was, it's a version of that that I was planning to read.
Oh, no. Great minds work together. What can I say?
I guess so. So never mind.
Oh, come on. You've got to, I know you. You have something to say.
No, not Crystalline.
No, not I. No, actually, I'll just sit and listen for a while because that really was what I called in. And since, like I told you last week, I can't seem to get on the board. It's just a way for me to listen in and comment.
Well, you know, Larry posted earlier. I had written the tech people at Blog Talk and asked them why some people can't get on the board, and they said it's typically one of two things. You need to update your what is it, Larry? Help me out here.
My registration. They basically tell me that my registration is not valid anymore.
Oh, really?
And as a result of that, when I try to enter my email address, they tell me, you're already registered, so I can't re-register. So it's kind of like a vicious circle, a catch-22. I can't register because I'm already registered, and the registration that I have, they say, is invalid, so I'm kind of just stuck in a loop.
Yeah,
but I don't want to take
that. There may be you may have a firewall blocking, which is often a problem, and then they said you need to upgrade to the newest version of I don't know if it's Real Player or which one it is, but it's
okay.
Yeah, so yeah. There's two. They gave me two steps that people can do that will typically fix the problem.
Okay.
And I'm trying to find it. Larry posted it on the board. And, of course, you know, there's just so much on the board, then you go back and try to find one post, you know, out of all the many, and it's really hard to find it.
Yes, Paula, I'm remembering, too, that email. He's written something.
Make sure that you don't have a firewall blocking the site. And what's the other one?
It was an update. Come on, Larry. It was an update of something that plays. He'll write it. He'll write it.
Yeah.
Y'all can hear me, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Larry had just asked, what does Silent Night sound like with a southern accent?
But to be back on what you were talking about, Andre and Paula, I think it's so important to say to the listeners that Jesus exemplified. I like to use the word exemplified as opposed to exemplified, because he was a true example of that very teaching of the human being, what the human life is on earth. And as you were asking the question, Andre, I was thinking in my mind about the fruits of the Spirit. Jesus kept saying, you know, you have to bear the fruits of the Spirit. And when I look at them from the first one to the last one, he embodied them, not only said, and the beauty about Jesus' life is that not only when we read his life and teachings does it apply to all human beings, it has no denomination whatsoever stuck to it. You know, it's the human denomination. As long as you're a human from planet Earth, you can make it. And I look at the very first fruit of the Spirit from love, goodness, joy, faith, peace, meekness, gentleness, temperance, long-suffering. He embodied them all as an example. Love, he kept talking about that the Father in heaven, his Father is the God of love. And then goodness, I mean, you couldn't have a better example of goodness than Jesus all throughout his whole life. Joy, he kept saying, I wrote to Mo the other day to congratulate him about his great work. And what did he say? A quote from Jesus, be of good cheer. So Jesus exemplified. And then faith, his whole ministry was about the faith, the connection, letting the Spirit, the divine Spirit dwelling within, direct you. That is religious faith, you know, the positive leading of the indwelling divine presence. And then peace, he left us. He left his apostles saying, my peace I leave with you. And then meekness, he said, you know, happy are the meek, so they shall inherit the earth. Gentleness, he kept talking about the sheep being gentle. And then temperance, sure, they had temperance all the way through. He had temperance all the way through his life with his apostles, to the point that he even sat with them, had even a glass or two of wine, and they would look at him, how dare he? But that was being human. He didn't get drunk. He would socialize with them. And long-suffering, well, he exemplified it to the utmost by his death on the cross. So instead of being just another high priest, and I'm not putting down anybody, God bless everybody's soul, but I'm just saying the beautiful human side of Jesus is that instead of coming on earth and playing this kingly role of I'm beyond all of you and I'm the best, forget the rest, it was not that. It was I am one with you, I'm one among you, and I am one of you, and I'll show it to you. I will be just like Paula read, you know, this beautiful poem that Crystalline wanted to share as well. I had no office, I had this, I had no roof to put over my head, but I never lacked anything. If my Father takes care of birds, you probably hear my little birds singing, you know, in the background. If God takes care of little birds, he'll take care of me and so much more of his own son, you know. And so he exemplified his teachings. He walked his talk all through his life. And that, to me, is universal. It's non-denominational. And the message is all there.
It's well, you know, you know what? Diane, when you just mentioned, we were talking about that song again earlier, What If God Was One of Us, and you said, you know, if Jesus was here today, would we recognize him? You know what I was thinking when you were mentioning that? I was thinking of that song again. I was thinking, you know, I bet Jesus, if he was here on earth today, I bet he would like that song. I bet he would say, hey, that's I bet you Jesus would say, hey, that's a good rock and roll. You know, we're gonna have a good time. You know, and that's the thing. I mean, Jesus is the kind of guy, Jesus is the kind of guy you could hang out with and have a pizza with. You know, he's the kind of guy that you would just be like, you know, he'd be like a regular guy. You know, and there's another thing you said I wanted to come back to, Diane. There's something you said, a minute ago. I know what I was going to say. You know, one of the things that I like to point out sometimes is that, you know, a lot of Christians will say, well, you need to humble yourself before God. But you know what? God is humble. And Jesus, and so God does not demand humility. He demonstrates humility, and he models it for us. So, you know, what is more humble than becoming a helpless baby? There's a song that some of you may know. Another song came out in 1982 by Amy Grant. It's a very popular Christian song. It was called El Shaddai. And there was one of the verses in the song says, through the years you made it clear that the time of Christ was near, but the people couldn't see what Messiah ought to be. And it says, though your word contained the plan, of course he believes the Bible is the word of God, but it says, they just could not understand. Your most awesome work was done through the frailty of your son. You know, so it's the, you know, when Paul talks about it this way, he says, you know, your strength is demonstrated in my weakness, you know, and it was the weakness of God on the cross, you know, the apparent weakness, I should say, really.
Meekness.
You know, the apparent weakness of God on the cross, the powerlessness of God on the cross, you know, when he was there, you know, saying, you know, Jesus could have done it. You know, he could have delivered himself. You know, he could have jumped off the cross if he wanted to. He could have, you know, he could have miraculously made sure that, you know, it's like Anne pointed out to us on one of the earlier shows, you know, Jesus even said in the Bible, you know, there are legions of angels who could deliver me at any moment, you know. But Jesus chose to demonstrate humility and to become, you know, to show his power by being powerless in a sense. You know, and I just, there's just so much there to think about.
And that's the true meaning of one of his fruit of the Spirit, meekness. When you look in the dictionary what the word meekness means, it means to submit, sub meaning under, to put yourself under. Well, again, he was an example. He put himself under his Father's will. He could have done all that you said, Andre, but he applied meekness.
You know, that leads me to a point I wanted to make. And before I do, I want to tell Chrislyn that what you want to do is upgrade your Flash player, and you can do it at Adobe.com to the most recent version of Flash. And that should let you on the talk board. The point that I want to make plays on what you and Andre are saying, Diane, and it is that I find it's just absolutely enthralling to think about Jesus as just the opposite of us, and in that he is, and this is a concept purely from the Urantia book. I don't know that I've ever heard this anywhere else. He's a descending son. The Urantia book tells us he's a descending son. He started on paradise in perfection and descends through time and space. And then we know from the book's teachings that the Heavenly Father requires of him that he bestows himself seven times, as, you know, he creates a universe with his counterpart, the creative mother spirit, the spirit of Nebadon. So we have a mother and father in this universe, and they create a universe, and they populate the universe with many free will intelligent beings. And then the Father requires that he bestows himself seven times as seven different descending orders beneath himself. And Anne and her group in Texas just did a wonderful celebration of the seven bestowals, as described in the Urantia book, from the 1st of December through the 7th of December, mm-hmm. and they celebrated one of the bestowals each day. It's a wonderful tradition that the Texas Society has taken up, and I want to salute you guys for doing that, Anne. But so you think, here is this perfect being who has come out from paradise, and he's going to, in a sense, downstep himself now all the way through time and eternity and space till he reaches this apex for him, the apex of his career, which is he becomes a babe on a material world like this. And the Urantia book tells
one of the worst material worlds.
Of course, and he had a choice about that. The Urantia book tells us that there were, 6 million inhabited worlds in Nebadon at that time, and he could have chosen any one of them. He could have chosen the most advanced. But there's a quote in the Urantia book that says, "The greater the love need in any creature, the more divine love seeks to fill that need."
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that
wow.
Our need is great.
Absolutely.
And because he's divine, and because he is divine love, he sought to fill our need for love. The creature need for love. And so he was love. He was a revelation of love to us on this most difficult world. But this life for him was the apex of a long, long, long career, a career in which we, as ascending sons, just the opposite of him, we start in imperfection and ascend to perfection. We're just beginning.
And I think you're showing to me something very important. This is something that I want to talk about here about the implications of the incarnation. That there's value in imperfection. You know, that there's a reason why God created, you know, why God allows imperfection, and why God, it's that whole interaction between the ascending and the descending, between infinity, you know, between eternity and time and space. You know, in classical Christian theology, our imperfection is a bad thing. It's a result of the fall, and it's something that we're supposed to, you know, that it wasn't really part of God's original plan, and that, you know, it was all supposed to be perfect harmony until Adam and Eve sinned and all this other stuff. But basically, you know, what the Urantia book is saying is, no, this is part of, imperfection is part of God's plan. You know, that's part of it for us. And I think something I think also that was always a puzzle to me until recently, I finally have accepted it, is, you know, I used to, one of the things that used to trouble me in the Arantia book is it says, you know, God is omniscient, but yet God's omniscience is existential. It's not experiential, meaning that God knows everything, but he knows it from an eternal existential point of view. He doesn't know it by direct experience. And that's one of the reasons why he created time and space, so he can directly experience imperfection. And how does he do that? Through the thought adjuster and through the creator's sons. And then also, you know, we have the supreme being. We have all this other stuff. So, I mean, again, I think the incarnation of Jesus is also another example of the value of imperfection, you know. And the book also says that he revealed God to man and man to God. So, you know, what is it that, you know, Jesus revealed to God by being human? You know, this enhances God the Supreme. I mean, there's so many directions we can go with this. It's just amazing.
And it's also, Andre, the value of experience. Even Jesus benefits from experience.
Well, I would like to say, go back, because this has to do with the implications. The Bestowal celebration, the idea was birthed here, and it's been remarkable, 2 years in a row. By the time you get back, when I say get back, because you feel like you go out in eternity, but with the first, the second, the third, and there's a deeper value applied to his Bestowal once you get to the seventh Bestowal. And this year I did something that we have a lot of new young readers reading the book, and you know we've talked before, if you're communicating with people under 30, you pretty much have to text. And we're trying to get Larry, our engineer, to come through that portal. And every day I text. Paula, you received that text. I text the reminder of, and next year I'll text it off of the computer to even a larger number of people. And they said how valuable it was to kick in their memory. And it's a marvelous way between when we believe he was born in August and then Thanksgiving to be thankful for his birth on the planet, to bring the light in, and then the typical Christian celebration. And I would like quickly here, we're talking about songs. One carol that you've probably never heard, this is actually sung in a Greek Orthodox church, and I enjoy going to the Orthodox church because, there's so much beauty there. Your birth did shine upon the world, and through the light of wisdom illuminating the universe. Many have come to know you, the Son of Righteousness, and to know you, the light from on high. Glory to you, O Lord. Isn't that beautiful?
Mm-hmm.
That's
wow.
That's a Christmas carol, but one that most of us have never heard before.
You must go through such a... I find you so lucky, Anne, to be in interfaith like that, because it to me, the way you speak, it gives you such a full scope of the human religious experience from different angles, you know, how it is lived through people. I think it's really an incredible venture, you know, to look at it from different angle, to get a 365-degree point of view so that you can understand and you can be right there in the center. And because the Urantia book tells us so much information about every religion and different religions, you can actually be able to converse with them, to exchange, to commune with them, you know, to fraternize with them. And they must feel like a sisterhood feeling with you, because you have this warmth and at the same time this knowledge from both sides. You get it from your personal side and then their side, so it must be such an incredible experience. And at
I marvel at it all the time. And the Zoroastrian,
yes.
You know, here I am preparing for this broadcast and to hear from a marvelous Zoroastrian priest, and I'm going to their celebration of the fire, and they don't worship fire. I guess y'all know that. They really have a grasp on the thought adjuster. I really like that about the Zoroastrians. And Paula, you know, the Parliament of World Religions. I always, and I've said many times that doing the expos with Paula, and I'm eternally grateful, that opened my mind up. And Diane, I don't know if you've ever heard me say this, or Andre, Paula has. I said this to the Interfaith Council introducing the book. I said, you know, I started out on a cotton farm in the hill country of Mississippi, in a very, very rural Baptist community where everybody, you know, it was a very tight community. And I said, you know, it's like the difference for me is going from being in the chicken yard, you know, with the chickens, and now having this eagle-eye view, thanks to all of you and the Urantia book. And notice those words. I really am thankful for those other viewpoints. And I said, what the Urantia book did for me was open me up to all the great religions on the planet. And that's what it did for me.
Yes.
The first thing I read about in the book was Melchizedek. And I was like, who was this man? So the again, Andre, going back to your thought-provoking questions, the implications of his bestowal. As y'all know, I'm looking here in a section of my library in my management books. You know, a lot of books have been written about applying the principles of Jesus' teachings in the executive world and management principles and the servant leadership model. And the Beatitudes, you know, the Beatitudes will go anywhere, a great philosophy of living. Andre, do you want us to sing Silent Night with all of our accents?
Do I want to sing? Are you kidding me?
Well, what about the ladies of the group singing a little bit of Silent Night for you?
I don't know if our listeners
actually,
are...
Actually, I would like to answer a little bit of something, Anne, to what you were saying in the question. Were you done, or you still want to add
kindly.
Something?
Thank you kindly. That was it.
Okay, thanks. So, Andre, my part of the answer, since Anne said her part, is that the implications. As you were talking, Andre, there's an expression that ran through my mind. It's easy when you're the greatest. It's easy. You can afford to be the humblest. And that's how
Ooh.
I see Jesus.
Ooh, I love that. What
you know?
Analogy.
Yes, and he could afford to be the humblest. But as that thought crossed my mind, I had a vision through my youth, and I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. Haven't you observed and laughed at times when you see people that think they are small and they do everything to pretend they're so big? So to me, the reverse is he was the greatest, so he could afford to be the humblest. But the way we can be the humblest is to be the little tadpole instead of trying to pretend to be the big frog. You know, and the perfect way to progress is, I would say, if we can become, let's say, a perfect tadpole, then we can move on to the next level. And that, to me, brings me to a very, very humble state of being, that the best we can do is accept where we are. We're a tadpole,
yes.
But it can be a heck of a lot of fun to be a tadpole, you know. And then we'll grow. Eventually, we'll grow, we'll grow. We'll become frogs. And then one day we'll meet Jesus. And then one day we'll reach paradise, you know. But in the meantime, let's be humble. That was one of the greatest. I can just visualize Jesus when he was living. Being with the biggies of the bigs, you know, the Pharisees and the high priest and the who is who, you know. And he would just stop right there and go help a little child.
That's one of the reasons why, you know, I was really moved by that piece that Paula read. And one of the reasons I wanted to bring it to is that it does seem that in our world, I think the internet is helping to alleviate some of that, but typically in our world we're just so impressed with credentials.
Yes, absolutely.
And as a culture, and believe it or not, it's much less that way in this country than in some other countries elsewhere. But just how unfortunate that it is that we didn't really get that from Jesus, that he really is no respecter of persons.
Mm-hmm.
And that the spiritual fruits that someone projects is just so much more important. And I'm thinking of this, there's a new television program, and I've only caught glimpses of it, but it's about like a millionaire going in to live with the poorest of the poor in this country. And at the end of the show, they have to sort of come clean to the people they've been hanging out with and admit to them that they're millionaires. And they choose certain amounts of money to give as gifts to these service groups or these really poor people that they've been working with. And one of the things that's really moved me, I've just seen the end of the show a couple of times, and that is that the experience of how it changes the millionaire, not so much the experience of how their gift of money changes the lives of the poor people they're staying with, but how being with people who are so interdependent and, you know, where they're so service-oriented, it really seems to move them. And
you
there's
know,
one last...
Go ahead.
No, I'll bring
ahead.
It up.
I'll hold on for a sec.
Well, I was just going to say that I'm having a hard time keeping track of my train of thoughts these days, but another thing I wanted to mention before I got off was that anybody who's a Urantia Book reader who's not on Facebook or Twitter or some of the sites, the social networking sites, you're really missing some really great opportunities for outreach, not only to people who don't know about the book, but to each other. And I would just I'm just sort of putting in a plug there for you to get on board. There's also a Blog Talk Radio host by the name of Nikki Starr, who talks about how to use these other media to get more people listening to your Blog Talk show. And I think that it's really important because this is such a great forum for us as Urantia Book readers.
Yeah, and Crystal, I got to stop you for a second because I want to totally affirm what you're saying. In fact, the more I think about this, I want to challenge our listeners. You know, there's no reason in the world why we can't have more than one Urantia-based radio show on this network. In fact, I think there is one other one. I could be wrong, but I think there's one other one already. But, you know, just like there's Christian radio, you know, and nobody says, oh, well, I'm going to be the only Christian ministry
mm-hmm.
on the air, you know, just like that, you know, this is not about competition, folks. This is about cooperation. This is about, you know, and if anybody, you know, as I said, just as there's Christian radio, why can't we, you know, there's no reason in the world why we cannot begin to saturate this network with, you know, Urantia-based radio shows. Absolutely no reason why.
Oh, Andre, I love what you just said.
I love the word saturate.
I mean, seriously, no, seriously, because you know what? Because there is
cooperation, not competition. Hear, hear, hear.
Because you know what? We can have, there's no reason why we can't have a dozen shows or whatever on this network.
You may ignite a show in my heart with, you know, focusing on interfaith. Diane, focus on health. They, you know, the health of the mind, body, and spirit.
Mm-hmm.
So,
you know, and I have to say, just for the sake of our listeners, those of you who may not read the Urantia book, we are not a cult. We do not want to convert anybody to anything.
Good
this
call.
Book is so beautiful and so liberating. Jesus said, you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free. And I've pondered, what will the truth make you free of? Well, I'm convinced it will make you free of guilt, doubt, shame, blame, fear, all of the things that poison our spirits and hold us down and make our lives desperate and wretched. The truth will set us free. And this book does that. And I have come to know it by that spiritual flavor and my only possible motive for wanting to share it with anybody is because I believe with all my heart, if it could make just one tiny percent of a difference in somebody's life that it's made in mine, my effort will be well spent. I have absolutely nothing to gain by sharing this book except the satisfaction that I might have helped a brother find the joy and peace and liberty that it's given me. We don't have a church. We don't have clergy. We don't have a secret circle of sacred inner knowledge. We don't have any of those things. We're just group of people who have found this book somewhere in our life, somewhere along the path, and man, the darn thing has made all the difference to us, and we want to share it. Why? Because we're altruistic, and because sometimes people like to share good things with other people, you know? Just like a good movie or a good book, the first thing you want to do is tell other people about it because it changed your life, because it's a good thing. We want to share it because it's a good thing.
Well, exactly. And, you know, and I have to say, Paula, we may not be a cult, but I am.
But, you know, that's the bottom line. That's the bottom line of it, because to me the message is, you were talking about the word implication, Andre, but to me I would go further and say, what's the application? Because there's implication, but then how do we apply it? And the application, the bottom line is that. How do we have this expressed in our daily personal religious experience? They say that, you know, even thinking of our thought adjuster, pre-personal, he needs our PRE, our personal religious experience, to become personal. So the bottom line is, how do we apply it? And spirituality, again, is non-denominational. It's lived, it's expressed, you know, it's applied in the daily life, like you say, Paula. And it's so beautiful. Why do we do this, Paula? I would say because we're in love. We're in the state of love.
Yes,
that's right. And you know what? And unfortunately,
good.
We are coming to the end, folks. We are coming to the end of our time, unfortunately. But let me just close by saying this, and that is, Paula, I want to piggyback on what you said, Paula, and what Diane just said about us being in love, and how just like we discover a great book or a great movie, we want to share it with people. And that, to me, is the real meaning of evangelism, if you want to call it that. We're not talking to people because we're afraid they're going to go to hell. We need to make sure that they need to be rescued from hell. That's not what this is about. This is about sharing good news. You know, if you had discovered the, you know, if you knew the cure for cancer, like, wouldn't you want people to know about it? You know,
right.
So the same way, you know, I don't try to. I personally have a hard time initiating. This may surprise people here, but I actually have a hard time initiating conversations about the book with people if I don't sense that they're spiritually hungry, or if I usually wait for people to ask questions or say something to me. You know, I usually
wait
for an opening.
That's wise, Andre.
But
you know what? We're out of time, guys.
Yes, we are out of time. But anyway.
Oh, no.
It's just getting good.
I know.
What a show. I know. Now, that's said in all humility, right?
Can I give every one of you a little gift that will take 5 seconds?
Yes.
Okay, it's very good. I read it this morning, and it goes along with what Crystalline was saying, the fruits of the Spirit. Let's remember one thing. God wants spiritual fruits, not religious nuts.
There we go. There we
Isn't
go.
Isn't that great? I think it's wonderful.
Okay, folks, we do need to scoot out of here and become and into the land of fruits, nuts, and flakes somewhere. I don't know.
Love you, love you, love you, love you, love you, everyone.
Bye,
everybody. Holy night.
Thanks so much for being with us on the show this
yes.
week.
Merry
we don't know
Christmas.
What we're doing next week, but we do know what we're doing once we know what we're doing. So.
Merry Christmas, everyone.
We'll let you know.
Bye, Andre.
We'll see you guys next week on The Cosmic Citizens. This is Andre Traversa with Paul Thompson, Ann Garner, Diane LeBrecq, Crystal, and thanks for calling. We had a great show. We'll have another great show next week. God bless everyone.